from KQED.
Hey there, everybody. From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer, Senior Politics Editor here at KQED.
And I'm Guy Marzorati. You know, I'm usually producing the show, but Marisa Lagos is out this week. I got some big shoes to fill.
Big shoes. He's making his move. The new guy in town, I guess we could say, although he's just usually on the other side of the glass. Marisa, I think she's out gallivanting, somewhere or other. But the show must go on, and today on The Breakdown, her earliest charge into politics involved integrating her high school cheerleading squad. Today, she is a leading voice for liberal causes in Washington, D.C.
That's right. Oakland Congresswoman Barbara Lee joins us, the only member of the entire U.S. Congress to vote against giving President Bush full authority to launch war after 9/11.
That vote looked a little better as time went by, I think.
Yes.
It's fair to say.
That and a lot more to talk about.
Took a lot of heat for that, but yeah, we're going to talk with her about that and maybe some talk that she might be running for a leadership position. But we're going to begin. You know, Guy, I don't know about you, but I thought maybe the week of July 4th would be a slow-ish news week. No.
You played yourself.
Ah, man, that doesn't happen anymore.
Yes.
There was a big court decision out of the Eastern District of California up in Sacramento. We all remember Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, flew back to Sacramento back in March just to say he was suing California. And today there was a decision by that judge John Mendez, who was ruling on the validity of three laws, including the so-called sanctuary state law, SB 54. That was the big one. And then two others as well. AB, you know these numbers. This was AB 103 was the one giving the attorney general sort of authority to, or really requiring them to inspect these private or public places where detainees are being kept. And then AB 450, David Chu's bill.
And I found it interesting. So much of the political talk around this legislation is about immigration. But if you read the decision today, I think the judge really framed this as a law enforcement case. You know, talking about this ruling is really, you know, making the argument or the ruling saying that this is not the law adding or subtracting any kind of burden on the state of California. This is really about what the federal government can force California to do from a law enforcement perspective. Interestingly enough, though, the judge did not totally stand away from making a political declaration.
He did at the very end. It was so interesting. And, you know, I mentioned his name, Judge John Mendez. He was appointed. He's a Republican appointed by George W. Bush when he was president. And at the very end of the decision, and I'm going to read it here, he says, "The court joins the ever-growing chorus of federal judges in urging our elected officials to set aside the partisan and polarizing politics dominating the current immigration debate and work in a cooperative and bipartisan fashion toward drafting and passing legislation that addresses this critical political issue." And then he ends with, "Our nation deserves it. Our Constitution demands it."
Yeah, a little advocacy from the bench at the end there. But I think overall, if you read through the ruling, it kind of sticks to the point. One quote was, you know, "Refusing to help is not the same as impeding." Another was, "Standing aside does not equate to standing in the way." Those are all arguments you heard from legislative Democrats last year when they were pushing for this law. You know, this is not blanket, you know, amnesty. This is more so, we really want to limit what California law enforcement is being required to do.
Yeah, and a lot of cities like San Francisco, Oakland, San Jose had already adopted their own local sanctuary city policies, but SB 54 made it a statewide policy. I talked to Kevin DeLeon, a state senator from Los Angeles today, who authored that legislation and got his reaction to the ruling.
We've said from day one that we are not going to interfere in the federal government's ability to execute federal immigration law. That's their role. But the state of California doesn't have to lift a single finger or spend a single cent tearing apart families who have been here 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years.
So, Guy, just really some vindication for Senator DeLeon, who, of course, is running now for the U.S. Senate against Dianne Feinstein.
Yeah, and I think everything that DeLeon does in his final months in the state Senate is kind of viewed through the prism of his run for U.S. Senate. And then this is the same, you know, I think he was happy to be out in front. You know, today he was both out in front on a press conference at the Capitol talking about a deal on net neutrality. Minutes later, he was talking about this victory for his bill in court. So I think for him, the more he can get himself out here tied to these national issues, both of those issues have national implications.
Earned media, as they call it, or free media. Interesting, too, that, you know, this issue has become a huge lightning rod President Trump loves to talk about it and tweet about it. We've seen certainly the Attorney General and the Vice President as well going down to the border with Mexico and making this an issue. They see this really as an issue that is going to galvanize Republican voters, and they like it. They like this as an issue, especially in some of those purple to red congressional districts.
Well, yeah, I mean, United States versus California is the name of this lawsuit, but it's also kind of what the federal government has promoted, and maybe to some extent Democrats here in the state have promoted on this issue of immigration and having California kind of stand apart. It was interesting to see over this last week this issue of abolish ICE, and especially to see our Senator Kamala Harris really take a lead, as she has, I think, on a lot of these immigration issues. Kind of, I don't think anyone is as tapped into the immigrant advocacy community like she is.
You know, remember, Dreamers especially.
The Dreamers especially. Remember back in February, she was one of the three senators to vote against that compromise legislation. She said she was uncomfortable with the amount of money that was going towards DHS. And then here with Abolish ICE, you know, she didn't call for the abolishment of ICE, but she was out ahead of all the other possible 2020 contenders and saying, we really need to look at a way to reform this agency.
Maybe melt ICE instead of abolishing it. And of course, the president was very quick to tweet and tying her, saying she's soft on the MS-13 gang. And she, in about a minute and a half, tweeted right back and said,
saying, you know, look, I've been a prosecutor, and a lot of the work, you know, that she touted was stuff that she had done as California's attorney general. And I think that's something that she can play. You know, I think when she went to the U.S. Senate, a lot of us were watching to see how she would transition from being a, you know, a top cop to being a kind of more liberal leader. And she's kind of finessing that right now. You know, she's been able to straddle that, to give voice to a lot of these immigrant advocates, but still come back and say, look, I have this prosecutorial experience to rely on.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly a rising star in the party. We'll see where that goes between now and 2020. All right, let's take a short break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Oakland Congresswoman Barbara Lee. So much to talk with her about. I don't know where to begin. But you're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Guy Marzorati, and today for Marisa Lagos, along with Scott Schaefer. And joining us now is a congresswoman who has served the East Bay for two decades on Capitol Hill.
Women's rights, equal rights, funding for HIV/AIDS. We're going to talk with Oakland Congresswoman Leah, and she is with us. So welcome to The Breakdown. So good to see you.
Glad to be home. Glad to see you both.
You know, we're going to get into a lot of stuff today, but I think we have to start with yesterday's first pitch at the Coliseum to kick off the A's game. And I have to say, for listeners...
He was there. He
for
was
listeners,
there.
I was watching on TV, but for listeners at home, you got to watch the video. This is not a Mariah Carey 50 Cent wild throw up the first baseline. This was a solid one-hop strike. So... props on that to begin with.
Okay. How did you prepare for that pitch? What did they tell you?
Oh, my God. Let me tell you. As long as I've been in public life, I think I was probably more anxious about yesterday than at any point in my public life. But I wanted to be there because this is the 50th anniversary, of course, of the Oakland A's, and I'm such a fan. So how could I say no when I was invited? But I have to tell you now, you got to remember, well, in the day, I was a cheerleader.
Yes.
But also I played baseball. I played volleyball. I played basketball. I was really...
I didn't hear softball.
Softball, baseball. I did
okay.
Both.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I did both.
Okay, cool.
And I actually played the piano also. So I won music scholarships. So there are a lot of aspects of my life that because of what I do now... that I just don't do anymore. And so...
What was your biggest fear? You said you were so nervous. Like, what were you nervous of? What did you fear? What was your worst fear?
My worst fear was because I didn't have enough time to practice. I practiced, I think, three times. The chair of the Congressional Black Caucus helped me, Congressman Cedric Richmond, for about 20 minutes.
Coach.
Yeah. And he helped me. And it, all of a sudden, it came back. But I had to also practice a couple more times by myself. And the fear, I guess, was, oh, my God, you know, I have to be perfect with this. You know, I went to Catholic school as a child, and you've got to be perfect. And not being perfect is not good. And so I felt like I was going to make a fool out of myself. And I didn't want to do that when in front of so many people with my constituents.
No, I'm telling you, the catcher's mitt did not even move. It was you know, you mentioned that you're cheerleading. I think people may be surprised to know that's kind of where your maybe political activism started as a cheerleader.
Yeah, you know, when we moved from Texas, segregated El Paso, Texas, to the San Fernando Valley, I attended San Fernando Junior High and San Fernando High School, and I wanted to be a cheerleader. But in the day, the school had a small committee that selected cheerleaders. And if you weren't blonde and blue-eyed, you weren't selected as a cheerleader. And I didn't look like that. And so I went to the NAACP. I was literally 15 years old. And I said, I really want to be a cheerleader. And I can't because I don't look right. And so the NAACP, to their credit, helped me. And they went up to the school and they said, look, you have got to change the way cheerleaders are selected because you're excluding girls of color.
So was that did that pop into your head? Was that your idea, or did somebody say, "Well, why don't you push this a little bit? See, you know,
no, it was my idea because I came from a family. My grandfather was in the NAACP in El Paso, Texas. My mother was very active in breaking a lot of glass ceilings. She was one of the first 12 students to integrate the University of Texas at El Paso with the NAACP's backing. And so that was kind of instinctive. It's like, I got to do something. And that's what I did. And so the NAACP went up to the school, Carl McCraven, John Mance, who I was actually doing work study, working at the credit union, and they were the managers of the credit union, and they changed the rules. And so what happened was the rules were changed where now girls had a chance to try out in front of the student body, and the student body would vote for who
that
they wanted as their cheerleader.
Me.
That was terrifying. But I was determined. Yeah. But guess what? I won. So I was the first African-American cheerleader at San Fernando High. But that year also, a Japanese-American, Jeannie Tanaka, won also. Mm. So that broke the glass ceiling for girls of color.
What was it like? You know, being the first is often tough. How did the other girls on the squad respond to your being there?
They were really happy.
Oh, good.
You know, because, again, it was myself and Jeannie Tanaka. There were two of us now who weren't blonde with blue eyes. And the rest of the girls really loved that. Joy Reed, you know, they were happy. They finally said, it's about time. And so I think by that breakthrough, it wasn't just about me. And it wasn't just about Jeannie, but it was about really the inclusion and breaking those barriers that many were afraid to break and talk about. But Joy and the rest of the girls who were white girls, they loved it. And we became friends and we're still friends.
Well, fast forward a few years, you made your way up here to the Bay Area. I think about the early 70s, you started working with the Black Panther Party. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, by that time, the public perception of the Black Panthers had kind of been formed. COINTELPRO was in effect. What was the party like? What, you know, drew you to them at that point?
Well, I know COINTELPRO. That's why I worry
now. Just say what that
about,
was.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, just describe that.
The J. Edgar Hoover's FBI program to target really Black activists. They targeted Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. They targeted the Black members of the Black Panther Party. And I was also a target because I worked with the Black Panther Party. Hmm. And so during that period, there were FBI agents who were sent, and I know who some of them were, thinking they were members of the party, but they were actually FBI agent provocateurs. Mm. They were plants. But I really thought that the 10-point program of the party was what I needed to work on. As a student, I was the president of the Black Student Union at Mills, and I mean, feeding hungry children, you know, passing out bags of groceries to people who needed food and shoes to people who didn't have any shoes, and educating the public about the systemic oppression and racism by helping sell newspapers. And my children, I was a single mom on welfare. They helped me do this also as little kids.
So you worked for him. He was running for mayor of Oakland in 1970.
This was about 72
or
72.
So. Yeah. So what was your fundraising pitch? You know, you would go into
Bobby
living
Seale
room,
for mayor.
Bobby
yeah,
Seale for mayor. Like, what was your pitch? You
I was Bobby Seale's fundraising coordinator. And he actually made it through the primary. And my pitch was, look, we have a chance to elect first the first African-American mayor who's a coalition builder. And he's fighting for systemic and institutional change. He wants to bring everyone together to change the system. So I would say here we have a chance now to really not just reform what's taking place, but to really break through so there could be inclusion at every levels and economic opportunities in Oakland. And we raised a lot of money for Bobby.
I mean, but you saw firsthand kind of the struggle to turn from activism you know, into politics for the Panthers. When you talk to young activists on the left today, is there advice you give them or lessons that can be learned from that movement and kind of the struggle to get into the mainstream maybe?
Sure, and I say to them all the time, you know, you are me then, because I did not want to register to vote. And I was a student at Mills College, and Shirley Chisholm came to campus. And let me tell you, I had a class in government. Part of the requirement was to work in a political campaign. And it was Muskie, McGovern, and Humphrey. I said, oh, no way. I'm not going to work in their campaigns. Forget it. And I flunked the class. I told my professor, flunk me.
Okay. You just didn't believe in the system, or what? Or you weren't inspired by those?
First of all, I didn't believe in the system because I was on welfare, right? And I was raising two kids, and it was really hard. And I didn't see the system responding to people like me. It was a struggle, and there were few opportunities. And so I said, if this is what politics is about in the system, then why do I want to be part of it, even though I was active? So I was conscious about why I wasn't engaged in politics. But Shirley Chisholm came to campus, and I told her I had this class I was getting ready to flunk. And you know, and she said she was running for president. I said, okay, well, then maybe I'll pass the class. But she said to me, and I'll never forget this, at the Student Union building, she said, little girl, she called me little girl. I had my two little kids, big afro. She said, you have got to register to vote and get involved, because you can't stay on the outside, you know, looking in and fighting from the outside. That's good, but you got to get on the inside. So I passed the class, got an A, and went on to Miami and was a Shirley Chisholm delegate.
I just want to say you're listening to Political Breakdown, if you just joined us, from KQED Public Radio. And tonight, our guest is Congresswoman Barbara Lee. She represents Oakland in Washington. Scott Schaefer here with Guy Marzorati this week. You know, you kind of alluded to it, but the fact that you didn't want to register to vote, didn't want to get involved, what does that teach you now, looking back, about how you get people who don't want to vote, who aren't registered to vote? How do you get them motivated? Because if Democrats are going to take back the House in November, you got to have some of those voters who haven't voted or don't vote in midterm elections.
You have to have them, and you have to really be able to make the case. I mean, younger voters especially need to know that you, first of all, are progressive. You understand that they want, for example, debt-free college education. You care about affordable housing. You care about their future. Mass incarceration, you're going to do something to stop this new era of Jim Crow, that you're going to fight for voting rights. You're going to fight for them. And they have to know that you have to be authentic. You have to really be able to, you know, let people know that you're there on their side and bring them in and listen. Because I tell you one thing, Shirley Chisholm, she listened. And I continue to listen to young people, because that's where a lot of new ideas come from. And that's how you formulate an agenda that speaks to everyone.
And so was it the Chisholm campaign that really got you locked in? You knew politics was what you wanted to do? Because I know you were also an intern during the summer of 1974. Pretty interesting time to be an intern on Capitol Hill.
Did you meet Hillary Clinton, by the way? Because she was an intern, too.
No, I did not. Or I may have.
She worked on the Senate side.
She was over on the Senate side. But there were, I think Sheila Jackson Lee was an intern on the Judiciary Committee then. But, I then met Ron Dellums, who was a progressive, great statesman, warrior against the Vietnam War. He reminded me, his agenda was similar to Shirley Chisholm's. I said, wait a minute. And I got to know Ron. And I applied to his office for a Cal in the Capitol internship, right? Now, here I had two little kids making maybe $2 an hour on public assistance, trying to figure out how to go to Washington, D.C. I figured it out. I was selected to go as a Cal in the Capitol intern during the Watergate era. And so I went to Washington, D.C. and
you
got a chance
kids with
to
you?
See. No, fortunately, I had a family. My kid's grandmother, my ex-husband's mother, she was such a great woman. She took the kids, and she had a farm in Texas, and she let them spend the summer in Texas. So I went on during Watergate, and I saw the helicopter take off from the White House. Nixon was deposed.
Iconic picture. You know, fast forwarding, of course, you were elected to Congress in 1998, I think. And, you know, a few years later, you cast a vote that really was one that stood out and got the nation's attention. You were the only member of the entire Congress not to vote to authorize, give President Bush the authorization to go to war after 9/11. We have a little bit of the speech you gave on the House floor that day. I think it was September 14th, I think, 2001. Let's hear a little bit of it.
However difficult this vote may be, some of us must urge the use of restraint. Our country is in a state of mourning. Some of us must say, let's step back for a moment. Let's just pause just for a minute and think through the implications of our actions today so that this does not spiral out of control.
What goes through your mind when you hear that?
Well, first I think of all the lives that were lost, you know.
On 9/11 or after?
On 9/11.
You were very emotional about that when you gave that speech.
Listen, it was very hard to give that speech because Sondre Swanson, who was my chief of staff, his cousin, Wanda Green, had perished in Flight 93 that we know was coming into the Capitol.
The one that crashed in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, crashed in Harrisburg, I think, Pennsylvania. And so to think of the families and the friends, I still, you know, am overwhelmed when I hear that and think about that because to this day, you know, people are still grieving behind that. And so, yeah, it was a very difficult time for me
what
personally.
What happened right after you cast that vote? Did anybody talk to you?
Right after I cast that vote, several members of Congress came back and talked to me out of genuine concern and friendship. And they said, Barbara, you cannot let this one red light stay up on that board. You've got to change it. This is going to kill you literally and your political life. I said, but look, this is 60. I responded, this is a 60-word blank check that's going to create perpetual war. I told them that. I said, I can't do that. I said, my dad's in the military, was in the military. I said, I know what this means when you send young people into harm's way and not know what you're doing. And this was, again, 60 words, open-ended. It's been used now over 41 times in countries never associated with or no organization associated with 9/11. So I stood my ground, and I knew, and these members came to me out of concern, and I thanked them. And I just went on, walked back to the Capitol, and by the time as I was walking back, my dad called me, retired Lieutenant Colonel, Barbara, stay strong. That's the right vote. He was in World War II, Korea, Lieutenant Colonel. And toward the end of his life, he even wanted me to call him Colonel Tut instead of Dad. So Colonel called me. My mother called me. You know, my pastor called me. My son's mother-in-law called me. People who were close to me, they said, stay strong. That was the right vote to cast. But by the time I got back to my office, oh, all hell had broken.
And that was before social media.
Right? Oh, but
17 years later, though, did any of those Congress members or other colleagues you have ever come up to you and said, you know what? I wish I had stood with you on that day and was a second or a third vote against that authorization.
Oh, a week later, several came up to me and said that. But I have to just say, 17 years later, last year in the Appropriations Committee, I I'm still trying to repeal that so we can have a new authorization, a vote and debate on these new wars that we're in, that this one they justify as legal basis. And all the Democrats voted for it, and all of the Republicans, except one, voted for it. It was an almost unanimous voice vote, got it out of the committee. By the time it got to the Rules Committee, the repeal of that, Paul Ryan, I think at the orders of Donald Trump, just took it out of the bill, 326-page bill. That section was just wiped out. And so we're going to do this until we do it. We're going to do this work, and it's going to get done. We're going to repeal that authorization.
Well, and in that regard, it'll be a lot easier to do that, or at least get it, the ball rolling a little further if Democrats control the House, if they take back control. And, you know, there's this real split in the party right now between, you know, this is a simplistic way to describe it, but the, you know, the Bernie-crats and the Hillary people, you know, the moderates, the liberals, people who want to forget about trying to get more working class white people to vote for them and really just go after folks who are the natural base of the Democratic Party. Where do you fall on that?
Well, I say it's not either or, first of all. And as an African-American woman who's been part of the Democratic Party since the 70s, I actually was chair of the, when I decided to register to vote, they elected me Northern California chair of the Young Democrats. So I've been trying to make the party more inclusive and more democratic. And as a member of the platform committee this last time, the drafting committee, we came up with a platform and I helped negotiate it between the Hillary delegates and the Bernie delegates that was the most progressive platform ever.
I remember in Philly, I was actually attended an event you did with Jesse Jackson.
Yeah.
With Bernie
with
Sanders.
Bernie. Yes. Yeah, and Danny Glover. And that was an event, a unity event. And it was great. And that's my role, I think, in the Democratic Party, because I have all my life been a coalition builder and try, because I can find the common ground. When you look at poverty, for example, the party has not really and the caucus has not really raised poverty to the level I think it should be raised, okay? So I finally broke through and got the Task Force on Poverty, Income Inequality, and Opportunity established. We have over 100 members in that on that task force, and we're doing now.
Any Republicans?
Listening to her. No, of course not. Paul Ryan, we... But bottom line is now we have Democrats beginning to talk about poverty. And the reason it's a unifier is this. You have poor white people in rural communities living below the poverty line. You have income inequality where people who are working two jobs living below the poverty line. And yet you have African-Americans, Latinos, Asian Pacific Americans living below the poverty line. So poverty can be a unifier when you talk about lifting people out of poverty and working on policies that provide opportunity and good paying jobs and access to the American dream for everyone. So I'm really fighting day and night with our party to try to get them to focus on poverty reduction and elimination, because I think that we'll be speaking to the really aspirations of the entire country.
And I mean, it sounds like you're throwing your hat in the ring a little bit for leadership position within the caucus, maybe after the 2018 midterms. I'm wondering, what do you think the party in Congress has to lose by bringing in new blood? You know, there's a lot of, division over whether Leader Pelosi should continue, possibly become Speaker if Democrats hold the House. You know, what's the danger in, you know, making that promise before the election to say, if you elect Democrats, we're going to revamp the people who have been leading our party?
Well, first, I'm focused on helping take back the House, and Leader Pelosi is, and she has been a phenomenal speaker. I mean, Leader Pelosi, we wouldn't have the Affordable Care Act if she had not developed the strategy to get that passed. So people, you know, need to understand what a phenomenal leader she is. And right now, we've got to take back the House to make sure we restore our system of checks and balances. And so that's what we're focused on, even though I'm talking to members about running for Democratic caucus chair, but focus is reelection. What I say is we need new members. We need younger members. We need people who are going to take the party to where it should go, where it's a party that speaks to low-income individuals, working-class individuals, the middle class, because believe you me, with this tax cut now, you're going to see more middle-income people falling into the ranks of the poor if we don't do something. So I think that we've got to take back the House, and we'll talk about leadership later, but I think Nancy Pelosi is doing a phenomenal job in making sure that we elect new and women, people of color. I mean, you should see the phenomenal candidates have gotten through the primary as a result of her leadership.
Well, Barbara Lee, we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for coming in. I know we have lots more to talk about. You got your papers all there, your briefing papers, but you know, it was just great to chat about your background and your time in Congress, and I'm sure you'll be there for a while longer. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Really good to be here.
Well, that does it for this edition of Political Breakdown, a production of KQED Public Radio.
You can check us out anytime. Find us on Apple Podcasts. Rate us well, review us,
Five stars.
Well, and subscribe.
Nina Thorson directed today's show because Guy Marzorati is here as co-host. Our engineer today, Rob Spate. Ethan Lindsay is our managing editor. Holly Kernan is our vice president of news. I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Scott Schaefer. That's clever.
And I'm Guy Marzorati. I'm at Twitter at Guy Marzorati. And that is a wrap for this week's Political Breakdown. We'll see you next time.
See you later.